something of a fashionable salon at her Bryanston Court apartment. "Her dinner parties have so much pep that no one wants to leave," observed Mary. She was suitably impressed by Wallace's interior decorating skills, save for her pink plush bedroom, which she found rather too much. During Mary's visit, Wallace was preparing for a girls-only holiday in Cannes, in the south of France, with boon companion Ethel Noyes, now Lady Lewis, Consuelo, and her sister Gloria Vanderbilt, and a new friend, Nada, Marchioness of Milford Haven, the daughter of Russian Grand Duke Michael. Mary Raffray came with Willis as far as Paris, where she was hit by a taxi, the accident leaving her badly bruised and shaken, but not critically injured, though she stayed in hospital as a precaution. Suitably reassured by her friend's improved condition, in August Wallace went on to the south of France to be reunited with Herman and Catherine Rogers. She and Lady Lewis stayed at their villa, Louvier, while the others stayed in a hotel. It was a belated 4th of July reunion for a crowd of Americans that included Sarah Elkin and former model Foxy Gwynn. Herman added a touch of culture to KT Hour by inviting local French composer Amadei Joseph Gabriel Vallombrosa to the party. Usually the lazy routine involved sailing out to an island on Herman's yacht, swimming in a hidden cove, and then enjoying a picnic on the beach. For Wallace, it was a welcome respite from business worries, the depressing London weather, and juggling the household budget. Ernest, alone and miserable, was left behind to watch the pennies and try to keep the shipping business afloat. In her memoir, she says briefly and incorrectly that Ernest was with her on the holiday. The reason became clear afterwards. 3 years later, her Riviera vacation made headlines for all the wrong reasons when the sexual shenanigans during the holiday were revealed, during a truly sensational custody battle between Wallace's friend Gloria Vanderbilt and her sister-in-law, Gertrude Whitney, over her daughter, also named Gloria. Gloria's maid, Maria Caillot, gave evidence stating that while Nada and Gloria were staying at the Cannes Hotel in August 1931, she saw them openly kissing, like lovers. Gloria's lesbian affair was proof positive that she was morally unfit to have custody of her own daughter. The sharp-eyed maid further revealed that Gloria pursued a merry-go-round of parties, was often drunk before breakfast, and was a devotee of erotic literature. At the time, the fact that Wallace had gone on holiday with Gloria and Nada, by then well known for her lesbian lifestyle, merely added to the lurid speculation about Wallace's own sexuality. As her biographer, Michael Block, noted, "There can be no doubt that all her life Wallace, with her rather masculine appearance, her brittle and self-possessed manner, exercised a great fascination on lesbians. Whether, apart from her female school crushes, that attraction was ever reciprocated has never been conclusively resolved." Whatever the subsequent sexual rumors that swirled around Wallace, that summer she was well on her way to becoming a fully paid-up member of the Prince of Wales's set. She met him again just before Christmas at a drinks party hosted by Thelma. After consulting with Thelma beforehand, she tremulously asked him if he would like to join them for supper at Bryanston Court. Thanks to Thelma's behind-the-scenes work, the prince graciously accepted. As this was to be her sternest test as a hostess, she decided on a typical southern dinner of black bean soup, grilled lobster, and fried chicken Maryland. The whole affair went swimmingly, and the prince paid her the compliment of asking for her recipe for raspberry souffle. Her kitchen goddess, Fanny Farmer, would have been proud. The stressful evening did, though, expose the tensions in the Simpson marriage. "She was snappy at Ernest," recalls Thelma, a snob to her polished fingertips. "It was all stand up, sit down, empty ashtrays. Ernest seemed servile, not quite out of the top drawer. Not to the manner born." After their successful dinner party, the Simpsons received a note from the prince in late January 1932, inviting them to spend the weekend at Fort Belvedere, his beloved weekend retreat. Once again, Thelma was the hidden hand in wrangling the invitation. Even before the words, "Yes, please," were out of her mouth, Wallace was worrying about her wardrobe for the most important weekend of her life. Chapter 8. A Shortlist of One. In the end, it was the one-eyed Admiral Lord Nelson, the hero of the Battle of Trafalgar, who saw to it that Wallace Simpson secured a berth at the table of the Prince of Wales. The prince, raised and educated in a naval family, always had a love for Britain's naval heritage. He found a fellow enthusiast in Ernest Simpson, the two amateur historians batting dates back and forth when he was a guest at Bryanston Court. When Thelma suggested that they invite the Simpsons to the fort for the weekend, initially the prince demurred. His conversations with Wallace, such as they were, felt awkward and stiff. He also found that her voice, a mixture of southern drawl and attempted received English pronunciation, grated on him. He agreed to Thelma's request with the proviso that she did not sit him next to Mrs. Simpson. "I can't stand her voice," he told her. Of course, Wallace was unaware of this social juggling. As an artful social climber, she felt only the extreme elation of reaching the royal summit. Fort Belvedere, a dilapidated, castellated folly on the edge of Windsor Park, was not a Buckingham Palace or a Balmoral, but the prince was proud to call it home. It was where he was at his most casual and at ease, the future sovereign, a wicked billhook in one hand, doing weekend battle with the weeds advancing on his garden kingdom. Excited but also scared to death by the prospect of spending a weekend in the prince's company, Wallace, who guzzled newspaper and magazine gossip about the prince as well as the morsels that Thelma and others fed her, was expecting several evenings of dancing and drinking until dawn. She was not alone in that mistaken view of the prince's nocturnal behavior. His father viewed Fort Belvedere on a similar moral level to Sodom and Gomorrah. In 1929, when he had asked his father, George V, for permission to make the royal Grace and Favor property his country retreat, the monarch had expostulated. "What could you possibly want that queer old place for? Those damn weekends, I suppose." His censorious father would have been as perplexed as Wallace when she first walked into the drawing room to see the future king engaged in what he called his secret vice, sewing a needlepoint backgammon cover. The surprises did not end there. Every evening at 6:30 prompt he went for an invigorating steam bath, would stand on his head at the drop of a hat, and regularly came down for dinner dressed in a kilt. Late at night he liked to march around the battlements playing the bagpipes, often accompanied by a guard's piper. During a simple dinner of Duchy of Cornwall oysters, roast beef, salad, and savory, Wallace noticed that Thelma and the prince's aide, George Trotter, worked hard to keep the conversation flowing and the prince amused. There was a little light card playing, a jigsaw puzzle to attack, and a brief interlude of dancing to the gramophone. When the prince coached Wallace at a card game called Red Dog, Wallace eagerly noticed that it was their first interaction where he had treated her as a woman rather than a guest to whom the host is just being polite. Thelma snobbishly noted that Wallace played cards like a little embassy secretary. This, though, was hardly the louche royal world of popular imagination. The prince headed for bed well before midnight to be ready for his next sortie in the garden. Thelma would follow soon afterwards, the unspoken ritual being that he would join her in her bedroom and leave at 8:30 in the morning. When George V telephoned early one morning, the prince's butler, Finch, was flustered when he could not find him in his bachelor quarters. Finally, he located him in Lady Furness's bedroom. At first, Wallace may have been disappointed to discover that the heart of royal darkness was a jigsaw puzzle, a needle and thread, and a gardening billhook. But she soon realized that the prince loved his time at his country retreat. Fort Belvedere was the first place in his life that he had been able to call home. The prince enlisting the help of his then-lover Frieda Dudley Ward, who had a flair for interior design, to remodel the place. He put in extra rooms, a swimming pool, and a tennis court. Unusually for a member of the royal family, he didn't even keep a horse for riding out. As a younger man, he was a fearless steeplechaser. But after a few spills, his father and Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin had famously asked him to stop this risky sport. It never worried him. The prince's twin passions were flying and golf, a game at the nearby Sunningdale course part of his weekend ritual. While Frieda began the remodeling of the fort, Thelma took the credit for redecorating his bedroom in the maroon and blue colors of his guards' regiment. As Queen Mary had refused to let him borrow pictures from the royal collection, Edwina Mountbatten loaned him 4 oils of hunting scenes to give the place a homey feel. The royal retreat was comfortable, even including radiators in every bedroom. But Wallace left thinking that it was very much a home for a bachelor. Even his terrier dogs, Cora and Jags, were unfriendly to female visitors, yapping and snapping when she came into the room. Not that she liked dogs, though she worked hard to be friendly, eager to be a good guest. As Thelma later remarked, "My father always said it's more difficult to be a good guest than a good host." Wallace was a good guest, trying to make a niche for herself, trying to please. It was clear that she wanted a return ticket. During that first weekend, Wallace, who was a quick study in human relationships, caught a flavor of the dynamic between her host and hostess. Though Thelma rather suggestively liked to light his after-dinner cigar, a knack she had learned in Cuba, in her chattering way there was no question that Thelma was the dominant figure in their relationship. It was clear that the prince, an inherently nervy man, idolized her, allowing her to, as Wallace observed, lead him around like a lapdog. She realized, too, that Thelma's dominance at the prince's court came at a price. She had to work hard to keep him amused and entertained, and needed other lively guests to shoulder the burden. As Thelma later recalled, "It was difficult with the prince, very difficult. All the time you were on the qui vive, on the lookout. You had to be gay and full of joie de vivre to keep him entertained. He was extremely nervous. He must always be doing something." As Ernest and Wallace drove back to central London on a wintry afternoon in late January 1932, Mrs. Simpson had much to ponder about that weekend. Her man of mystery had become even more mysterious, the king of nightclubs and needlepoint. Divining his complex character would have to wait. The Simpsons had problems of their own. Such was the state of Ernest's shipping business that they tried to move out of Bryanston Court in order to save money. They gave up their car and made economies elsewhere. A trip to Tunis was paid for by their host, while their summer holiday with Aunt Bessie, traveling round France and Austria, was cut short by a recurrence of Wallace's perforated ulcer, which required days of bed rest. By contrast, the prince and Thelma enjoyed a rather more louche summer, as guests of his good friend Eric, Lord Ednam, now the newly minted 3rd Earl of Dudley, who had rented a villa in the hills above Biarritz. As well as the prince and Thelma, he had invited Prince George and a number of wealthy American heiresses and socialites, including Barbara Hutton, Chicago socialite Julie Shipman, and Prince George's lover, Beth Leary. 2 years earlier, in July 1930, Eric's wife Rosemary had been tragically killed in a plane crash. Thelma remembers that it was the only time she ever saw the prince cry. They were staying at the fort when George Trotter broke the news. He was devastated, tears rolling down his cheeks. Thelma recalled, "It was a terrible shock for him. He crumpled at the news. I've never seen a man more genuinely unhappy. He was very, very sad for a long time." The prince explained to Thelma that he had met the then-Lady Rosemary Levison Gower, the daughter of the Duke of Sutherland, in 1917, when she was working as a Red Cross nurse in France. Then aged 23, the prince fell in love and promptly asked her to marry him. When he broached the subject with his parents, they would not hear of it. Even though the king had proclaimed that his children could now marry English commoners, it was felt that there was a taint in the blood. That is to say, a streak of madness in Lady Rosemary's mother's family, the St. Clair Erskines. Lady Victor Paget, one of Rosemary's closest friends, recalls that the prince was bitter and furious about the king's decision. "I don't think he ever forgave his father. I also felt that from that time on, he had made up his mind that he would never make what might be called a suitable marriage to please his family." All his later relationships were with married women, or women he met for casual liaisons. The only exception was Princess Marina of Greece and Denmark, who was wooed by the prince throughout 1926, but, according to diarist Chips Channon, Frieda Dudley Ward, at the last moment, interfered and stopped it. As for Lady Rosemary, in 1919 she married the prince's close friend Eric, then Lord Ednam, his host that summer. After they married, the prince was a frequent visitor at Himley Hall, the Dudley family seat, and it was subsequently rumored that their eldest son, William, was sired by his godfather, the Prince of Wales. He had often visited the family home when Rosemary was alone. As with Thelma's son, Tony, this gossip pursued William till the day he died, though he bore the rumors with good humor. During their holiday in Biarritz, the prince was an indulgent father figure to Thelma's son. Though only 5 years old, Tony was a proficient reader, the prince encouraging him to read articles from the Times out loud. He bought him a miniature set of golf clubs and set about teaching the youngster the rudiments of the game at the local Schiebertag golf course, which was designed in 1927 by Tom Simpson with the prince in mind. More adult entertainment was provided by Thelma's one-time beau, silent screen star Charlie Chaplin, and the famed Russian opera singer Fyodor Shalyapin. Both performed for the delighted prince at a restaurant in the nearby resort of Saint-Jean-de-Luz. Shalyapin made the Prince of Wales's love life seem positively prosaic. He managed to have two separate families by two different women in Moscow and Leningrad, St. Petersburg, while he dwelt in Paris. The holiday is best remembered, though, for an incident that began the slow uncoupling between the prince and his paramour. On impulse, Thelma suggested that she would like to go to Lourdes, the Roman Catholic shrine in southern France where the waters were famous for curing the sick and the lame. As the 100-mile journey along narrow roads would take all day, the prince suggested he fly her there. Within hours, the prince and Thelma found themselves kneeling in a muddy field in supplication as a priest went by carrying the Blessed Sacrament. Though it was a private and supposedly anonymous visit, word got out. And when the prince returned to York House, he found a deluge of letters asking why the future head of the Protestant Church of England was praying at a Catholic shrine. The consensus, inside and outside the palace, was that a certain Lady Furness was leading the Prince of Wales astray. The end of the Biarritz holiday marked another, more significant turning point. Once back in London, Thelma decided to formally go ahead and divorce her husband, Duke. After all, she reasoned, they had been separated for 3 years and there was no chance of a reconciliation. Her friends pleaded with her to reconsider, seeing the consequences, social and financial, of her folly. What she failed to realize was that she was unknowingly signing her own death warrant, her decision unsettling the status quo between her and the Prince of Wales. As a married but separated woman, she was the ideal foil for the prince. There was no chance of her ever marrying the prince or of her marrying another. He had a wife, in all but name, available but not free. It was a trade-off. In turn, she enjoyed the status of proximity to the throne. As she later observed somewhat ruefully, The biggest mistake I made was in divorcing Duke. But after all, the Prince of Wales was very glamorous. I thought it would last forever. I was wrong. As the weekends at the fort should have taught Thelma, the prince was a creature of habit. He liked the familiarity of routine. Though he was now turning 40 and still a bachelor, for all his adult life he had had a woman by his side, and that woman was married. Thelma should have learned from her own experience. In 1929, when Frieda Dudley Ward decided to divorce her husband, William, it was no coincidence that the prince's gaze just happened to fall on Thelma Furness. Their chance encounters on a train to Paris and at a cattle show in Leicester were orchestrated by two social predators looking for new mates. Their union worked smoothly because both knew the rules. Now Thelma was breaking the compact that existed between them. In January 1933, when a judge granted Thelma a divorce on the grounds of her husband's adultery, she was skating on very thin ice. Her husband was not slow in remarrying, a few months later taking the plunge for the third time with strapping 6-foot Australian adventuress Enid Cavendish, the widow of Brigadier General Frederick Cavendish, known as Caviar. Duke showered her with jewels and bought her a tame cheetah. But there was no doubt who was the bigger cat. From the moment Thelma told her royal lover that she was now divorced, consciously or unconsciously, the prince was on the prowl, hunting fresh meat. This was one leopard who did not change his spots. In the back of his mind, he knew that at some point in the not-too-distant future, the newly single Thelma would announce that she had found another rich man and that she intended to remarry. It was all so predictable. It might happen in days or weeks or it could take months, but it would happen, of that there was no doubt. Signs of waning adoration were easy to spot. Thelma booked herself into a hotel in Wales for 2 weeks for a rest cure, as she found life with the prince rather strenuous. She came to rely more and more on her friends to keep the prince entertained. For his part, whether or not he would ever admit it, the prince was casually on the lookout for a married woman who would dance attendance on him and a husband who would do a Nelson, that is to say, turn a blind eye. Thelma's divorce in January 1933 coincided with more frequent invitations for the Simpsons to spend weekends of scything, singing, and dancing at the fort. A regular absentee was Ernest, who was often abroad on business trips as he endeavored to save his company. Wallace became, in her words, a merry widow, flitting from the fort to parties and dinners in London and the home counties. On one occasion, she went skating on the nearby lake in Windsor Great Park with the Duke and Duchess of York. It was not all hijinks. During one sedate weekend, an exasperated Wallace complained that Thelma's father was reading out loud from Dickens' David Copperfield as his daughter and the prince worked silently on their needlework. When Prince George was a guest, evenings were much more lively. After dinner, he would play the piano, usually beginning with Love's Old Sweet Song, which is more popularly known as Just a Song at Twilight, before segueing into tunes the party could dance to. His elder brother loved to sing along to the drinking song from Sigmund Romberg's hit Broadway musical, The Student Prince. Not only were invitations to the fort more frequent, but the prince took to calling on the Simpsons at Bryanston Court for dinner or a KT. Wallace and Ernest were accepted as part of the prince's inner circle, and from around this time, invitations to grand social events began to plop through the letterbox. Her burgeoning British social life was put on hold for a couple of months when, at the end of March 1933, Wallace boarded the Mauritania for a much-anticipated voyage to Washington and Baltimore to visit family and friends. As the Isle of Wight dropped below the horizon, a messenger dashed over with a cable, wishing her a safe crossing and a speedy return. It was signed Edward P., the prince's name garnering her respectful treatment for the journey. As she commented, "Let me be candid. The attention was flattering. I enjoyed every minute of it." In her memoir, she stated that she and Ernest sailed together and that the princely Bon Voyage telegram was addressed to them both. In fact, Ernest stayed in London, Wallace sailing alone, her ticket paid for by Aunt Bessie. Her assertion was Wallace's way of disguising the prince's growing interest in her, always eager in her memoirs and elsewhere to suggest that she was the innocent at large buffeted by forces beyond her control. "If the prince was in any way drawn to me," she wrote, "I was unaware of his interest." She was being deliberately insincere. Her false inclusion of Ernest on her solo Atlantic voyage, proof that she was well aware of the implication behind the prince's message. In her airbrushed narrative, decorum always trumped ambition and desire. In fact, now Lady Furness was single, if still attached to the prince, the future king was gently testing the water elsewhere, without getting into hot water. He was not the only one. Unknown to Ernest, the prince, or Thelma, Wallace was about to embark on a little hunting of her own. They were not the only big cats in the social jungle. Dark-haired Courtney Letts, a renowned society beauty, celebrated Arctic explorer, and best-selling travel writer, carefully opened a silver photo frame displayed on a side table in the library of the Argentinian Embassy in Washington, where her fiancé, Felipe Espiel, was ambassador. There were tears in her eyes, but anger in her heart as she took out the glossy black-and-white photograph of an angular-faced woman gazing unblinking into the camera lens. She struck a match and watched, with a mixture of glee and regret, as the picture of Wallace Simpson flared into flames, disintegrating before her eyes. While she felt shame at having given in to her deep, if irrational, feelings of jealousy, she felt a sense of release, too. In some way, burning Wallace had broken the spell cast over her by her love rival, who had recently returned to Washington for a 2-month visit. This behavior was provoked by an earlier conversation with the embassy's Spanish butler. The night before, he had watched in horror as Wallace made her way to the second-floor bedroom suite occupied by Felipe. She and Lady Lewis had spent what seemed like an eternity looking over his collection of photographs, pausing for some time over the pictures of Courtney, the two women sizing her up. Eventually, the butler, who was appalled that women had entered these bachelor quarters, interrupted their snooping. "I went in and asked if there was anything they needed," the butler later told Courtney, adding with scarcely disguised disdain, "They laughed and went downstairs." The news of Wallace's late-night incursion provoked mixed feelings in Courtney's heart. She knew all about Wallace's torrid dalliance with her husband-to-be during the 1920s, when she was still married to Navy aviator Wynne Spencer. Questions, though, remained. What was she doing in Washington? Why had she visited the Argentinian embassy? And what was she doing in Felipe's bedroom? Though she trusted her fiancé, she remembered her father's warning about dating Latin men. The worm of doubt entered her soul. There was already talk in diplomatic circles that Wallace's second marriage, to Ernest Simpson, was in trouble. Could it be that the ambitious Mrs. Simpson was testing the romantic waters with her former flame? That, at least, was how Courtney Letts interpreted Wallace's behavior. She found it suspicious that Wallace had wangled an invitation to dinner at the Argentinian embassy. A dinner, moreover, which Courtney was unable to attend, and which was hosted by Felipe. Nor was this the first time they had met since their grand affair. When Felipe had been in London a couple of years earlier, they had seen each other at several cocktail parties, notably at her home at Bryanston Court and a reception for the Prince of Wales hosted by Lady Furness. If she had been present at the embassy dinner, Courtney would have been even more apprehensive. She would have noticed that Wallace had dressed to impress, wearing a black chiffon dress with a white gardenia, her hair brushed so finely that, as society photographer Cecil Beaton would later describe it, a fly would slip on it. At the same time, she would have been consoled by the studiously upright behavior of Felipe, who kept his distance from her, only speaking with Wallace towards the end of the evening. The next day, still recovering from the butler's horrified observations, Courtney was astonished to come across Wallace sitting nearby having lunch with two other women in a Washington hotel. Even though their paths had crossed romantically with both Felipe and Jerry Green, they had never met, and so they ignored one another. Courtney was dining with an out-of-town friend who was not aware of her engagement to Felipe, and it was her friend who spotted Wallace in the restaurant. "Do you know Wallace Simpson?" she asked. In order to see what she would say, Courtney answered in the negative. "I wonder why she is here," her friend continued. "I hear she and her husband don't hit it off any too well." She was Espiel's mistress for several years. Courtney later recorded in her diary, "Said just like that. I felt a horrible shock run through me. We continued eating. I fled soon after with a, 'Sorry, I have an engagement immediately after.'" As concerned as Courtney was, she need not have worried. What she didn't realize was that the girl from Baltimore had attracted the attention of a man of far grander title than a mere plenipotentiary. Namely, His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales. Several months later, on July 28, 1933, Courtney and Ambassador Espiel married, the first ambassador for 50 years to marry in post in Washington. Though Courtney was now safely hitched, she kept a beady eye on Wallace from afar, quizzing passing diplomats and politicians about developments in Britain. Her husband, too, would continue to play an unexpected role in romantic affairs of the Royal House of Windsor. Unaware of the suspicion she had aroused inside the Argentinian embassy, for the next 2 months the girl known as Wally had a gay old time, catching up with her friends and squired around Washington by any number of admirers. A particular favorite was American diplomat and wine connoisseur John C. Wiley, who was soon to marry the artist and writer Irina Baruch. She had such fun that the prospect of returning to dull domestic routine back in London in May held little appeal. Wallace had enjoyed being the center of attention from her boys. Once back in London, Wallace yearned to be with her compatriots. Even invitations to the fort or out to nightclubs with the prince and Thelma failed to excite her enthusiasm. Her spirits were lifted when, in June, an influx of American diplomats, including her Washington beau, John Wiley, arrived in the capital for the London Economic Conference, where 66 nations gathered to discuss the global crisis. Wiley treated her to a birthday lunch on June 19th, and that evening the Prince and Thelma hosted a birthday dinner for her at the cavernous Quaglino's restaurant on Berry Street. The Prince gave her a present of an orchid plant for her 37th birthday, promising that with careful tending it would bloom in a year. So it did. The modest present, of the type that the Prince would give to his housekeeper, hardly suggested a budding affair. Nor, 6 months later, did his Christmas gift of a framed photograph, a standard royal present for senior servants, anticipate the deluge of gems to come. While the departure in July of the American diplomats had left a hole in her social calendar, it was filled by the much-anticipated arrival of Lelia, the daughter of her cousin Lelia Montagu Barnett. The younger Lelia was at the center of a marital merry-go-round that had turned the Montagu clan upside down. Lelia's married sister, Anne, had fallen in love with Newbold Noyes, the married journalist brother of Wallace's great friend Lady Lewis. Unfortunately for Anne, Newbold Noyes was madly in love with her sister Lelia, who was also married. When Lelia and her friend Madge Larrabee arrived in London, Wallace was eager to catch up with the twists and turns in this unfolding family drama, a drama that eventually left all three marriages in ruins. For their part, Lelia and Madge were given a sense of Cousin Wallace's proximity to the crown. When they visited her at Bryanston Court after a night out at the theater, they were thrilled to meet the Prince of Wales and Lady Furness. He played the bagpipes for them, stood on his head, and presented Madge with a book of war photographs that he had intended for Ernest. They all had such a jolly time that the prince didn't leave until 3 in the morning. When Lelia and Madge returned home, Wallace couldn't help but feel homesick. London seemed somehow emptier and less gay without the American diplomats and her cousin. She envied Thelma when she told her that she, too, was sailing to New York in January to see her sister Gloria. "I am going to miss Thelma terribly," she told her aunt. Days before Thelma sailed, Wallace met her for lunch at the Ritz Hotel. During their meeting, Wallace recalled, Thelma said, "I'm afraid the prince is going to be lonely. Wallace, won't you look after him?" Thelma's memory is rather different. It was Wallace who blurted out, "Oh, Thelma, the little man is going to be so lonely." To which Thelma responded, "Well, dear, you look after him for me while I'm away. See that he does not get into any mischief, and for heaven's sake, stop calling him the little man." "It was later evident," said Thelma ruefully, "that Wallace took my advice all too literally. I trusted Wallace. It never entered my head that she was making a play for the prince." Given subsequent events, the implication of Thelma's account is that Wallace was waiting in the wings and swooped down on her man once she was safely out of the way. Thelma was betrayed by a trusted friend. The reality was that Wallace was a bystander in an emotional untangling between the prince and Thelma. The prince was Thelma's to lose, not Wallace's to win. In Thelma's account, she said her fond farewells to the prince at the fort. As she drove away, the forlorn figure of the future king standing in the driveway made her regret her decision to leave. After all, there was no particular reason for her to visit America. It was, in her words, to recharge my batteries, to see her sister and take a trip to California. The prince sent her long and frequent cables, all carefully coded to conceal their intimate nature. When she and her sister Gloria arrived in Hollywood, they were the talk of the United Artists studio when Thelma received a long-distance telephone call from the prince. It was a brief and inconclusive chat, the prince desperately wanting to know when she was coming home. Then a storm in the Atlantic ended the conversation prematurely. A storm was indeed brewing. Shortly before leaving for England, Thelma attended a dinner party in New York, where she was seated next to Ali Khan, one of the richest unattached men in Europe. He was the playboy son of the Aga Khan, who was regarded by Ismaili Muslims as the divine descendant of the Prophet. His son, who was only 22, already had an international reputation as a sportsman, driving his sports cars as hard as he rode his horses. Dark, handsome, attentive, and effortlessly charming, he wooed women easily. Thelma was no exception. The morning after the dinner party, he sent 5 dozen long-stemmed American Beauty roses to her apartment, and he dined with her that evening at the fashionable Colony restaurant. The next day there were more roses, followed by cocktails at the Ritz-Carlton. He asked her to join him for lunch the following day, but she refused, saying that her ship was due to sail. When she entered her stateroom on board ship, she found the cabin crowded with roses and a note from Ali that read, "You left too soon." As the Bremen slipped out of New York, her phone rang. "Hello, darling, it's Ali. Will you have lunch with me today?" Thinking it was a ship-to-shore call, she answered gaily, "Where will it be, Ali? Palm Beach or New York?" Ali laughed. "Right here. I'm on board." He entertained and flattered her all the way back to England, asking her to marry him during the 6-day voyage. The road with the prince leads nowhere, he shot, an arrow that hit an emotional bullseye in Thelma's heart. When they docked at Southampton, Thelma offered to give Ali a ride back to London in her car. As they waited to disembark, the prince called her on the ship's telephone and asked her to join him at the fort for supper. She said she couldn't, as she was giving a friend a ride to London. Instead, she and the prince arranged to meet at her London home at 8:30 for supper. It was a stiff, awkward, and somewhat forlorn reunion. The prince talked about the rotten weather, the state of the garden at the fort, and his golf, until finally, as they sat sipping coffee by the fireplace, he spoke about what was really on his mind. I hear Ali Khan has been very attentive to you, he said, his blue eyes burning into her. Are you jealous, darling? She asked. A heavy silence hung between them. The damage had been done. He informed her that people were gossiping, and it would be better if they just saw each other now and again and let the relationship end naturally. I thought that was very nice of him, she recalled. He asked her to the fort that weekend, and she, like a nitwit, asked him if the Simpsons could come too, as they were gay and it would make matters easier. The next day, Thelma called Wallace and asked if she could visit her at Bryanston Court. When she arrived, she was surprised to see Wallace looking more chic and groomed, her clothes more expensive and her voice more English. Thelma told her story about Ali and how she was amazed that the prince did not want to make a new start, or at least offer to make a new start. Wallace reassured her that the prince was simply lost without her, answering in the negative the inevitable question about whether the prince had transferred his love to another American. Thelma, she said, I think he likes me. He may be fond of me, but if you mean is he in love with me, the answer is definitely no. While Thelma had showed her hand, the poker-faced Mrs. Simpson was playing her cards close to her chest. There had indeed been an emotional step change in her royal relationship. While Thelma was away, Wallace joined the prince and his friends, NBC radio executive Fred Bate and his wife, Jeeb, at the Dorchester Hotel. During dinner, the prince and Wallace made a soul connection over the unlikely subject of working practices in Britain and America. The prince had just returned from the industrial north of England, and encouraged by Wallace's unwavering eye contact and focus, he let down his guard, chatting enthusiastically about the limitations of his job and the role he believed royalty could play in shaping Britain's future. Amidst talk about American labor unions, industrial output, steel scaffolding, and radiators, a bond was forged. From the moment he said, Wallace, you're the only woman who's ever been interested in my job, she knew the prince was also interested in her. When she asked him directly if he was lonely and he replied yes, she knew that she had made a connection. The prince looked at her with new eyes, something clicking deep in his soul. She was no longer the house guest or hostess manquée, but a woman of interest. Novelist Upton Sinclair, who was Wallace's cousin, sketched out her seduction technique in his short play, Wally for Queen. It was remarkably like her encounter at the Dorchester. Wallace coyly explains to Edward her skills at making herself helpful to a man.
A woman notes that men like to talk about themselves. She learns to listen and be interested. Every man, no matter how much he blusters, is really lonely and uneasy, a child to the woman. It's her task to make him wonderful to himself, and not let him know she is doing it.
From that evening, the helpful Mrs. Simpson increasingly became the focus of his attention. He would call her on the telephone 2 or 3 times a day, arrive at the Simpson home early and stay late, regularly sitting down with the couple for potluck suppers. It soon became clear to Wallace, as it had been to Thelma and Frida, that the future king was a profoundly lonely man who needed constant attention and coddling. As the weeks passed, the dinners with the Simpsons as a trio became dinners à deux. Ernest happy for his wife to dine alone with the prince. Not only did he consider it an honor, it gave him time to focus on trying to save his ailing shipping business. While Thelma was away, the prince asked Wallace to organize his weekends at the fort. Now her friends, who included Kitty and George Hunter and Gladys and Patrick Anderson, joined the Simpsons in entertaining the prince. It was noticeable that Wallace was always the first to be asked to join the prince for after-dinner dancing. The most obvious sign of their growing friendship and convivial intimacy was the fact that the prince now affectionately teased her accent, much to her smiling irritation. It was not long before the rumor mill began churning, Wallace throwing her hands up in mock exasperation.
"I'm not in the habit of taking my girlfriend's bows. I think I do amuse him. I'm the comedy relief, and we like to dance together."
For all her complaints that the prince was exhausting, secretly she was loving it all. Not that Wallace gave a hint to Thelma of her true feelings or the cordial familiarity she now shared with the future king during their awkward tete-a-tete at her London apartment. Then the telephone rang. It was the Prince of Wales. Wallace answered the call, but when she returned made no mention of the content. She did, though, agree that she and Ernest would travel down to the fort together for the weekend. At dinner the first night, Thelma, nursing a heavy cold, sat opposite the prince while Wallace sat next to him. He picked at the salad with his fingers, and Wallace patted his hand as if saying, "Naughty boy, you must not eat with your fingers." Thelma recalled that moment.
"I was so surprised that I caught her eye and shook my head at her. She looked straight at me, and I knew what had happened. Wallace, of all people, Wallace, to whom I had given my clothes, loaned my court train, staged parties, coaxed the prince to invite to the fort, and even gone to for advice."
After dinner, she retired to bed early, blaming her cold. For once, she was not on hand to light the prince's after-dinner cigar. A little later, the prince came into her room and sat on the edge of the bed. She looked him in the eye and said, "Is it Wallace, darling?" He said, "Don't be silly," and got up and walked out. The next morning, she left the fort and went to Paris where, surprise, surprise, Allie was waiting. They then drove down to Spain for a riotous pell-mell week of champagne, caviar, and fornication, cold forgotten. What infuriated Thelma was that, even though she had been open and honest about Allie, Wallace had never given a hint that matters had changed between her and the prince.
"Why didn't she tell me before we went down to the fort? I gave her such an opening. She could have said, 'Oh, darling, I am so happy you have told me, because since you've been away, this is what's happened. We couldn't help it, it just happened. After all, I couldn't have been a dog in a manger.'"
The reason why she couldn't have been a dog in a manger was because she wasn't being entirely honest herself. According to her friend and business partner Sonia Rosenberg, her passionate romance with Allie began much earlier than she suggested, and was the justification for sailing to New York in the first place. During their time in New York, Allie gave her jewelry and clothes, buying her every style of dress from Sonia's store. "Thelma was Allie's lover long before she and the prince broke up," recalled Sonia. As with Duke Furness and the Prince of Wales, Thelma tried to have it all, wanting both Allie and the prince in her life. Thelma didn't leave the prince, he left her. It was over Allie, Sonia remembered. "She came to America for him. I know, I was there. The prince heard about it, and he cabled her to come back. She was a little frightened. Here she is stupid. She let Allie come back on the same ship with her. Even though he was not the jealous type, it was just too much for the prince. She could have stayed with the prince. He was crazy about her. Again, she was a fool. She went to the well too often." From the moment she drove out of the fort on her way to Paris, her life went downhill. Allie soon cheated on her. He eventually married Joan Barbara Guinness in May 1936 after she fell pregnant. A few days after her royal departure, she called the prince from Paris about a charity event she was organizing for him. The prince coldly told her that he had decided to cancel it. She replied, "I suppose it's said that the king can do no wrong. I don't like to hang up on anybody, but goodbye." With that, she banged down the receiver. In a last jab, she wrote, "I wish to God he had found somebody who could make him happy and not a figure of fun." Her abrupt departure from Fort Belvedere meant that there was now a job vacancy for the post of the Prince of Wales's mistress. In the spring of 1934, there was a short list of one. Chapter 9. A Bounder, a Libertine, and a Spy. Wallace and Ernest celebrated their sixth wedding anniversary in July 1934 by going their separate ways. He sailed for New York on business. She traveled to Biarritz. The departure signaled the beginning of the end of their marriage, the period when Wallace fell in love with another man. For the next 2 months, she spent every day as guest, companion, and confidant of the Prince of Wales, sunbathing, eating, talking, getting to know one another. He had taken a spacious villa in the hills above Biarritz, the resort where he had entertained various mistresses, including Lady Furness and her twin, Gloria Vanderbilt. None, though, ever spent quite as long with the future king as Mrs. Simpson. Since Thelma's dramatic exit, Wallace had slipped seamlessly into her role as hostess and entertainer-in-chief of the Prince of Wales. She had kept the prince at bay sexually by ensuring that she never was with him in a situation that would encourage greater intimacy. Their holiday would test that resolve to the limit and beyond. It seems she succeeded in remaining chaste, both Wallace and the prince declaring that they never had carnal relations before they eventually married. Ostensibly, her Aunt Bessie was her chaperone, although she left the small royal party to go on a motoring tour when the prince and his guests joined Lord Moyne on his yacht, Rosaura, a converted channel steamer, for a cruise along the Portuguese and Spanish coast. After weathering a fierce storm, they eventually reached Formentor on the island of Majorca, where they spent the days swimming and daydreaming on the beach, the evenings watching flamenco dancers or dancing themselves on the beautiful lantern-lit terraces overlooking the sea. For both of them, it was a special 5 days, the time when, as Wallace described it, they crossed the line that marks the indefinable boundary between friendship and love. They had reached a point of no return in their relationship. As she later confessed, "I had indeed met a man. David and I were falling in love. There was nothing either of us could do about it. Like all true love stories, it had to be. It took us a while to realize what was happening, and we did not quite know what to do. There was no long-range or short-range plan. I was still married, and that was that." The prince marked this romantic interlude by composing a slow melody for the bagpipes, which he called Majorca, and quietly handing her a diamond and emerald charm for her bracelet, purchased when they reached the seaside town of Cannes in the south of France. Within hours of their docking, Wallace was reunited with the other man in her life, Herman Rogers. He and Catherine had only just returned from a month-long cruise on their yacht, the Angelique, when Wallace and the prince came a-calling. That night they entertained the couple and the other two in the party, Posy Guinness, the beautiful cousin of Lord Moyne, and the prince's equerry, Major Jack Aird, at their villa. After Herman showed them his films of Peking and Bali, the sextet went out on the town until 5 in the morning. The next day they sailed to Saint-Tropez, the prince having such a good time that he invited Herman and Catherine to join them on a trip to Lake Como in Italy. In a breathless and hitherto unpublished 6-page letter to his sister Anne, Herman described the events of the holiday. Typically, the ever-discreet friend never once hinted at a relationship between the prince and the woman he and Catherine hosted for 4 months in Peking. Of the trip, he wrote, "Wallace is quicker on the trigger than anyone I know, and we always had something to laugh at. It couldn't have been more informal or more fun." They swam, played golf, hired sculling boats, dined late and woke at noon. Herman got on famously with the prince, something of a shipboard bromance developing between the two men. "He couldn't be more generous or simple or more fun to be with. I have never met anyone with so much charm. All the stories you hear of his drinking and foolishness are wrong. No one could be more thoughtful of others." The Rogerses returned to their Cannes home to find themselves the center of gossip and a terrible jealousy among the local community. Herman wrote to his sister Anne telling her that one so-called friend had remarked, "Of course the Rogers would never see anything of the prince normally. He's just slumming now." That was but a fraction of the rumor and hearsay that began to erupt around Wallace. When Aunt Bessie, who had been reunited with the party at Villa d'Este by Lake Como, managed to see her alone before she sailed for New York, she voiced her concern to a resolutely unconcerned niece. Tentatively, she broached the subject of the Prince of Wales's fondness for Wallace, but Wallace airily brushed her observations aside. For once, Aunt Bessie continued her questioning. "Isn't this all very dangerous for you? If you let yourself enjoy this kind of life, it will make you very restless and dissatisfied with everything you have known before." Wallace wouldn't hear of it. "It's all great fun. You don't have to worry about me. I know what I'm doing." Grimly, her aunt told her that she could see no happy outcome to this situation. Her concern was entirely for Wallace, who had, following her failed marriage to Wynne Spencer, found stability and contentment with Ernest. She knew that her niece was at last enjoying married life and that her husband, an educated, witty fellow, clearly adored her. "He had a marvelous mind for history and dates," she recalled. Wallace could do worse, much worse. Now she was risking being left high and dry because of a summer infatuation with the Prince of Wales. It was bound to end in tears once the prince's attention was captured by another bright, shiny object. Never for a moment did Aunt Bessie imagine that it would be Ernest who was left maritally marooned. As she recalled, "She would have stayed with Ernest, but she was hit by this avalanche. On the other hand, I suppose it is quite a compliment to be picked out." As far as Wallace was concerned, she was a woman of the world enjoying her time in the royal sun, but knowing that soon enough the sun would set. She was now 38, and realized that she had only a few years left before she was firmly placed on the shelf. As she recalled, "I had on my return no illusions about my future, or rather the future of David and myself. No girl in her right mind would have ever thought that a king would abdicate over her." Her Montague side enjoyed living the dream. Her Warfield half realized it would come to an end soon enough. All the evidence from the prince's life pointed in that direction. As she later recalled, "There were at least a dozen girls who had lasted one summer with David. But when the next year rolled around, they were forgotten." For the moment, she was happy being Wallace in Wonderland, and her husband seemed content to indulge her as she lived this enchanted lifestyle. In her mind, she was simply playing the prince's game like those who had come before her. When the prince gave Wallace a dog, a Cairn Terrier he called Slipper, for Christmas, she smiled inwardly, knowing that he had also given a dog to Thelma, a Pekingese called Puff, at a similar stage in their relationship. Then there was the diamond and emerald charm he handed her in Cannes. It was not too personal and would not raise too many questions from an inquisitive husband, rather like the black-and-white pearl earrings and cabochon emerald ring he had given Thelma. As Thelma remarked, how can you give a married woman a lot of expensive presents without her husband knowing about it? Ernest knew all about